Late Night Live, ideas and opinions from around the world.
G'day, beloved listeners. Welcome to the second of our more or less Anzac programs. Shortly, you'll be hearing a view of Gallipoli that you haven't heard before. But first of all, we're going to take you to a concentration camp in Australia dating from 1915. Now, over the years, I've often talked to you about the Dunera boys and about how we had a concentration camp for Jews on the Hay Plains, where on one side of the barbed wire, kangaroos bounded around, and on the other, some strange, surreal semblance of Viennese cafe society was created by the largely Jewish refugees who'd fled Germany and Austria after Kristallnacht, where they did the most extraordinary things. One of my favourite stories about them is that they had their own currency called the Gdonyas, based on hearing this phrase over and over and again. Good on you, good on you. I've actually got some good on yous at home. Well, tonight we're going back, as I said, to another concentration camp. And let me introduce it, the way an Australian officer welcomed Martin Trojan and 7,000 of his fellow internees to the camp at Holsworthy, southwest of Sydney, in July of that year. Yes, bloody German bastards. Authors Gerhard Fischer and Nadine Helmy put together stories of Trojan and the other interns in a new book, The Enemy at Home. Trojan, a second officer on a merchant steamer when World War One erupted, became the first group of enemy aliens to be interned here. Amongst the number, Paul Dobotsky, a very talented 22-year-old Bavarian photographer, whose rare pictures of theatrical events, small businesses, and sports, cultural events that boosted the men's spirits in the camp are also included in the book. Now, to tell us more about the life of the interns in the Holsworthy, Trial Bay and Berrima camps, joined in Sydney by Gerhard Fischer, Associate Professor of German Studies at the University of New South Wales, and his co-author Nadine Helmy, curator, playwright and theatre director. Gerhard, you write that the policy of internment was a factor in the political climate in which Australia was obviously participating in World War One. Germans and German Australians, the imagined internal enemy. Set the scene for me.
Well, before the war, there was a fairly large and prominent, well-established German-Australian community located primarily in South Australia and Queensland, but also in the big cities everywhere, of course. There were roughly about 100,000 German Australians, about 33,000 who were actually born in Germany. And they had been living here for quite a number of years and were generally well regarded as Australian migrants and well integrated into the Australian society.
Are we talking Catholics, Lutherans?
Everything.
Everybody.
Yeah. Primarily, they would have been Lutherans, and the Lutheran Church was one of the key cultural factors in their community. And they mostly felt as Australians. Many of them had been naturalized here, and quite a few ended up in turn had actually been born in Australia.
I hadn't realized they represented the largest non-British immigrant group.
Yes, they had always been until World War One. Mind you, there was still only a small percentage of the overall population, but they were certainly well established. They had German clubs, they had German orchestras and Liedertafeln, and they played a significant part in the general cultural life. Yeah.
Now, of course, Billy Hughes's ambition was to create not only a whiter than white Australia, but a very pomified Australia. Was there a change of attitude towards the Germans when the process of interning them began?
Yes, I think so. Within a few months, really, the climate changed very, very much. The Germans, our Germans, as they were sometimes referred to, simply became enemy aliens and enemy figures.
So like a light had been switched off or on, as dramatic as that.
Yes, I think so, yeah.
Oh, dear. Okay, and how did the German interns react to finding them suddenly surrounded by people who didn't like them anymore?
Well, they were shocked. I mean, they were really devastated. And one also needs to consider that internment and after the war deportation were really only the tip of the iceberg. There was a whole set of legislation directed against the resident enemy population here. There were the War Precautions Act, Trading with the Enemy Acts, and I think it was the war aim, really, of Billy Hughes to destroy this German-Australian community as a sort of autonomous socio-cultural entity.
Before this happened, there must have been some in the German community who felt their loyalties torn.
Yes, I think so. But if you read the declarations of all the leading members of the German-Australian community, the pastors, the businessmen, they would have considered themselves Australian foremost and first of all, and they certainly would have felt that their political loyalty lay with the country which had become their home.
Nadine, do we know whether there were any German Jews in the camp?
We do. There are no proper sources, but you can guess from the names, the obviously Jewish names that appear, that there was a number of Jews interned, and they figure prominently amongst, not surprisingly, the performing arts.
Which I want to get to shortly via these extraordinary photographs, because they're terrific. Let's look at some of the characters in the book. The very talented photographer, Dubotsky, leaves his home in Bavaria to accompany a scientific expedition to China. How did he end up here?
Well, I wish I could tell you, but that is one of the things that remains in the dark. We know from his family, and when I say family, I'm talking of his one surviving elderly daughter. All they know is that he joined an expedition to China, and his photos that remain that he took during his travels show that he traveled through Malaysia, Burma, and Singapore. How he ended up in Australia is, we don't know. I personally suspect that as he found himself at the outbreak of the war in New Guinea, that he possibly caught a ship in the chaos of the First World War and ended up in Australia. In any case, his last address is in South Australia in Adelaide.
He was pretty good, wasn't he, as a photographer? These are a good, candid, intelligent photographs. They're not forced or over-stylized. They've got a great ability to tell a story.
Definitely. And this is what I picked up on when I visited the archives of Trial Bay in 2004. And these photos caught immediately my eye because of the immediacy, then the expression they have. You are kind of amongst what happened.
He's a bit ahead of his time stylistically, isn't he?
Well, I like to compare him to August Sander, which is a big deal. And I do think that some of the photos, which we also exhibit in at the Museum of Sydney, are truly masterpieces that match what August Sander produced, who's a well-known photographer.
Mm. I understand that you went to Munich and you met his daughters.
I unfortunately could only meet one of the daughters because the other one, the night before I arrived, had died. Which, of course,
made the night before.
And unfortunately, also, apart from that, it's a fact, sad, sad fact anyway, she was the one with a better memory. So I nevertheless was committed to go through the collection because I had to return to Australia with a list of what was available. So it was not unstressful. to do that.
Gerhard, he grew up in, quote, a powerful industrial Germany. There was an economic dimension to the policy of internment. Tell us what that was.
I think it was one of the primary aims of the Prime Minister, Billy Hughes, to destroy what he considered was the German economic conspiracy. Hughes had this...
What, in the diaspora, you mean?
Yeah, yes. He thought there were business interests in Frankfurt and Berlin who, through various agents in places like Melbourne or Sydney, were directing economic activities and profits towards Germany. And he just wanted to put a stop to this. And this trading with the enemy legislation was not designed simply to stop current contracts where metals and wool, for instance, would be shipped to Germany. Germany was one of the biggest wool buyers at the time, but also to make sure that there was no economic activity with Germany after the war. Jews were really intent on putting his economic eggs into the one basket, which was the empire. Empire products for empire markets, that was one of his slogans. And he just wanted to make sure that there were no German businesses operating here in Australia.
You're listening to LNL on Radio National, etc. My guest, Gerhard Fischer, Nadine Helming, co-authors of The Enemy at Home. Give us some examples of why people were ostensibly interned, Gerhard. I take it there wasn't just one reason that the authorities would have modulated their arguments from time to time.
No, it was to some extent a fairly arbitrary, haphazard process. So
weren't a group of Slavic miners interned following a campaign by local traders?
Yes, there was a campaign by the mining unions in Western Australia in the Kalgoorlie goldfields, who refused to work together with what they called enemy labour. So the unions actually went on strike, and that put the employers and the government in a pretty difficult position because they were obviously interested in keeping the production going. But the outcome of long negotiations simply were that a few hundred of these Yugoslav mining workers were arrested, interned, shipped across the continent, and interned in Holsworthy.
So people could be denounced either by professional colleagues or business competitors and get them heading for the camp.
Yes, I think so. Mm. And that happened quite frequently. Or it was maybe simply neighbors who were running a real estate agency and thought that while the Aussies were fighting and the German real estate agent was going on his trade, that should not happen. So they wrote letters to the police.
Well, look at what happened to the possessions, the lands of the Japanese who were interned in California in the Second World War. There's always opportunists, aren't there?
Yes.
Who will seize the moment to their financial advantage. I've opened the book quite arbitrarily here, Nadine, and I come across a photo which I particularly enjoy. It shows a couple of gentlemen, one with a cigar clamped between his teeth, the other smoking a mere cigarette, and they're in women's undies.
Yes, it's
Could you explain this to me, please?
It's a hilarious one, and it's one of my personal favourites. Well, you know, in Germany, one of our major cultural institutions until this very day are the theatres.
Yes.
So it was only natural that being interned, and once people knew, the internees knew that they'd have to stay there for a while, they thought about putting up theatres. And luckily there were some ship's carpenters who could quite quickly purpose-built theatres that had orchestra pits, stages, and seated, like the one in Holsworthy, seated about 300 people.
Is that right?
Yes, and in fact, a historian called Scott, I don't know his first name, stated that the theatres in the camps, regarding their repertoire, sets, etc., actually were superior to the ones, the contemporaneous ones in Sydney and Melbourne. This is Scott.
There's a previous spread, which is a production shot from a play, and I must say, the woman, who isn't really a woman, is remarkably beautiful. In fact, quite a few of the fellas came up pretty well with a few wigs and makeup, didn't they?
They were incredibly convincing because, of course, that was the biggest problem. The materials problem could be overcome after a while. Also, you know, the sets and everything that was construction. Then people proved talented at writing plays or even writing music, but there were, of course, no females. But the urge to see performances and to perform, to have this theatre happening was so
and
strong.
And to have femininity evoked.
That's right, and to have femininity, then saw the first bloke enter the stage. Two, of course, incredible laughter at first. There is actually one book was written by one of the internees, a journalist who had come to Australia to research a travel book, was interned, and became the resident theatre director of Holsworthy, and later, instead of the travel book, published a book, Our Theatre in Internment. So we've got detailed stories of how it felt when the first woman entered the stage. And, you know, there was laughter at first. But after a while, yes, the desire to believe the femininity was stronger.
As with the De Niro stories, there are societies of all sorts, little cafes and clubs, newspapers, tennis courts, kitchen gardens. This suggests that, as with De Niro, there was quite a good relationship between the internees and the guards.
I wouldn't go quite as far. What happened was that the Australians were really overwhelmed to administer such a huge camp, and they weren't prepared for it. But gradually, the internees got given more and more permission to regulate their own affairs. And so they went into action, and of course with the usual German efficiency. And they were basically let to do so. So there was, I don't think it was a particularly friendly relationship, but they were left to do what they wanted to do.
Gerhard, tell us about Trial Bay, where Martin Trajan was kept. Profoundly different or a variation on the theme?
Well, Trial Bay was, along with Berrima, one of the elite camps. The big camp in Holsworthy had about 6,000 people, and it was very rough and basic there with very basic sanitary facilities. In Trial Bay, about 500 of the, well, they called themselves the upper 500. They were interned in the old jail, which was reopened and made into a camp. And they had a pretty good life there, one must say. They had a parole area outside of
the jail. I'm sorry, what set them apart? Were they wealthy or professionals?
They were wealthy, and they were ship's captains, for instance, and they were receiving their salaries from their companies. So there was quite a lot of money around, which went into the camp economy. They were privileged in the sense that they were not behind barbed wire. They could actually go out of the camp onto the beach in Trial Bay and swim and fish and build little cafes on the beach and had tennis tournaments and what have you.
I think Late Night Live could have set up there because they attended lectures on history, anthropology, chemistry, modern languages.
Yes. Yeah, you could actually become a fully trained marine machinist. They had a fully accredited course, so you could get a professional qualification.
But Gerhard, there was a dark side of the moon. Tell us about the Black Hand.
The Black Hand, again, that is the Holsworthy camp.
Oh, is it?
Yes. So didn't have anything like this, neither in Trial Bay nor at Berrima.
But you did have a mafia-style gang that terrorized the big camp.
Well, it happened. It happened because there were, of course, people from all walks of life in that huge camp. There were wealthier people, really poor people, a lot of criminal elements, you know, that the Australians had also put into the camp. And so there was blackmail of the poorer people, you know, and criminal elements. They blackmailed the richer ones and beat them up and so on. And the camp commandant, Sands, had a good look at that, didn't do anything. until the few soldiers that were interned, in fact, the only so-called prisoners of war, from Tsingtao and some men from the Emden, decided to take matters in their own hands and beat the mafia gang up and threw them over the fence. And all that the commandant did was to tell his soldiers to take photos of this event, which we also exhibit.
Gerhard, every year at this time, Australia it focuses on the mythologies of Anzac, and we dissect it and look at it from every angle. We're going to have another crack at it after you leave the studio. But this has got to be factored in, doesn't it? This story, which hardly any of us know.
Yes, and I think that's a pity, perhaps. It's simply true that today the Australian school children, or maybe Australians generally, know more about what happened at Anzac Cove and Lone Pine than what happened at home here in their country. And in a sense, this story of the home front experience is a sort of a counter-narrative to the Anzac story, because the Anzacs supposedly discovered their defining features and of identity, mateship, for example, at Gallipoli, while here in Australia, the Australian government actually encouraged people to dob in their mates, or people who had been their mates only a few weeks earlier. And also, the diggers found a sense of their Australian identity rather than being British as they were before. While again, the Australian government pursued a policy which strengthened the British population and was meant to forge closer links with the empire rather than developing a sort of unique, independent Australian national identity.
I've often told the story in the program about what happened to the De Niro boys afterwards. Many of them stayed on and made quite disproportionate contributions to a wide variety of Australian realms, theatre, the law, media, etc., etc. What happened to these blokes after they were released? Did they go back reluctantly or happily to their communities?
Well, unfortunately, the story is more that they were not allowed to stay. They were deported. They were summarily deported. There were some 6,000 people in the camps at the end of the war. And the policy of the Australian government, again, was not to let them stay in Australia, but force them to be what they called repatriated, even though a lot of
even
them,
though that wasn't the right word, was
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah.
Now, that's a terrible part of the story.
I think so, too. And it's really a unique thing in Australian history. This kind of mass deportation has not ever happened ever since or before. So, again, it's part of a story that is largely forgotten, and I think it's really a sobering idea to confront this with this nationalist Anzac myth.
Well, the book comes at just the right time to do that. The Enemy at Home, German Internees in World War One Australia. But so will your exhibition, Nadine. Tell us about it.
Yes, well, the exhibition at the Museum of Sydney will open on the 7th of May and go until September 11. So there is plenty of time to have a look and catch up on what happened here. And it's while we document, of course, the historical side with the photos, there is this amazing story of the life behind the barbed wire. The photos, we've talked about them, of these men in their petticoats who make really convincing heroines, and the sports that happened, and all in photos that are of really superior artistic quality. They are stunning, they live, they are intense.
Well, I can vouch for that, because I'm just riffling through them in the book as we speak. Gerhard Fischer, Nadine Helmy, co-authors The Enemy at Home, an Historic Houses Trust and University of New South Wales Press publication. Good on them. Coming up, Gallipoli and the experiences of Frederick Septimus Kelly and Herbert Moran. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Philip.